This podcast contains the personal stories, opinions, and experiences of its speakers rather than those of Breast Cancer Now. Welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast, providing support and information to anyone affected by breast cancer. I'm Laura Price, and I'm the host of the Breast Cancer Now podcast. I'm a food writer and author, and I live with secondary breast cancer. Today on the podcast, we are talking to Fran Whitfield, a cancer exercise and rehab specialist with an extraordinary story. Fran was diagnosed with secondary breast cancer when she was just 25 years old. She was told she had just 2 years to live. Nearly 4 years later, Fran is 29 years old and has responded incredibly well to her treatment. She's now working to help other people with cancer to exercise their way to better health and to become stronger both physically and mentally. Some of you may have heard of Fran before because she featured on the Breast Cancer Now podcast in 2021. I was so struck by her incredible strength, which helped me through my own secondary diagnosis in 2022. Fran and I met at one of the brilliant get-togethers she does for young women with breast cancer at Future Dreams House, the Breast Cancer Support Centre in London. She inspired me to take up weightlifting after my own major surgery last year, and that has been a real game changer for me. Fran, thank you so much for joining us on the Breast Cancer Now podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's really great to have you here. Thank you. So could you start by telling the listeners about your diagnosis and the treatment you've had?
Yeah, of course. So I actually originally found my lump, strangely, about 5 years to the day. So like 5 years to this month. I found my lump when I was 24, and then I went to the GP as an emergency appointment. She confirmed that the lump was there and then sent me to the breast clinic to then get it ultrasounded. But when I went there, the doctor that I saw said to me that because of my age, it was most likely going to be a hormonal lump, that I didn't need a scan. And then sent me on my way with no further information, anything like that. So for 18 months, I didn't realise that the lump itself, how large it was growing, because it was growing inwards, until July 2020, when a dimple appeared. And I knew that that wasn't a good sign, because obviously I'd read information before in my blind panic the night before the GP appointment. And so instantly booked in to get testing done. And 3 days later, after having a biopsy done, they confirmed that it was breast cancer. And thankfully, the doctor that I saw at the time, as a kind of precaution, just decided to do a full body head-to-toe PET scan. And it was pretty much my saving grace that he did, because then they discovered that I had a brain tumour on that PET scan. So that was the kickstart of my treatment. Within 2 weeks of finding that out, they then did the surgery to remove the tumour, did all the testing, confirmed that it was the same genetics as the breast. So that instantly then made me stage four. So that was in the August 2020. And then I recovered from the surgery about 4 weeks, and then I started chemo. So I had 6 months of chemo from the September 2020 through to March 2021. And then after the chemo, then they did the radiotherapy to my skull, just to make sure that it wouldn't come back. I had a 50-50 chance, essentially, of the tumour coming back if I didn't have it. So I had the radiotherapy, CyberKnife radiotherapy, which is a great new technique that they've got now, and had that done. And then I've been on medication ever since. So I've been on abemaciclib. I did have Zoladex, but I've had to stop that now due to some side effects that I was getting. And then tamoxifen as well. So I've been on that since May 2021. Yeah, I got my all clear in the September 2021. So actually, since doing the podcast here last time, yeah, I got the all clear. And I've been NED since then.
NED is no evidence of disease.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I've had the no evidence of disease since September 2021.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So I did originally go from the 2 year... Yeah, as you mentioned, the two-year prognosis. But I quickly moved hospitals after I got that diagnosis. Was not going to have someone tell me that I had 2 years to live and put me on palliative care. And then I then moved to the Royal Marsden, which is where I am now. And then, yeah, I've got the all clear. And then I turned 30 this year. So kind of went from going, I'm not ever going to see my 30th birthday. I remember saying that to my mum the day that we found out the news, to, yeah, Fingers crossed, touch wood. I get my 30th birthday this year.
And I met you on your 28th birthday. And I remember you saying then, like, I was not meant to see this day.
No.
And, you know, now you're turning 30 this year. So it's absolutely incredible. But just going back to that, being told that you only had 2 years to live, how did that feel? And how did you deal with that mentally?
I think at first I was inevitably, you know, you're numb, you're shocked. Didn't really know how to respond to someone telling me that I only was going to potentially see my 27th birthday and nothing more. But very quickly I then felt a lot of anger towards that situation, and not so much the situation itself, but anger towards someone telling me that, that they were deciding that I had that long to live, whereas I wanted to try everything that I could to counteract that, and I wanted to be put on treatment, and I wanted to try everything that I could that was out there. And that's exactly what we did. We moved, and then my new oncologist said to me, I'm prepared to put you through everything if you're prepared to take it. And I was like, hit me with it, let's go, and I'll do it, which we did. And now I'm incredibly thankful that I did do that, and I didn't just kind of succumb to the diagnosis that I had. And I was my own self-advocate, and I pushed for it, and I believed in myself as well, which I think was a huge thing. So even in that moment of complete terror and fear, I knew that I had the fire in my gut to try as much as I could. I wanted to see my 30th, essentially. That's all I wanted to do in that kind of, in that moment. I was like, everyone, you know, my friends are celebrating, I have older friends and they're celebrating their 30th, and I want to do that. I want to have the party. And yeah, so it was the anger that kind of got me through it, I would say. I sort of internalized that in as fuel and fire to actually go through the fight for it.
I mean, I really hope that that will inspire people given a similarly bleak prognosis to fight against that, and obviously that's not always possible, and sometimes it is realistic, but to be told that in the first instance by a doctor and to be not offered any hope at any age is horrendous. But at 25 years old, like, you know, that's the beginning of your life, and hopefully your story will give a lot of people a lot of hope.
Yeah, I hope so. And I think I'm trying to prove that you can be your own self-advocate. I think a lot of people are quite fearful of standing up and saying, actually, no, I don't want to do that, and I do want a second opinion. Or a lot of people don't actually know that second opinions exist. So I know that I've spoken to a lot of women that have read my story that now have gone and got second opinions, or have said, actually, no, I don't want that. Or, I've heard of this other treatment plan. Can we investigate this? And they're actually have an input in terms of what their treatment is, and you're well within your right to do that. And as you say, sometimes it's not possible, but if you feel like that is possible, or you just want to explore it, then 100% do that and have those discussions with your oncologist, or get those second opinions if you're not finding that you're gelling with the team that you have, because it's incredibly important that you have the backing of your oncology team behind you all the way, and that you feel comfortable and you trust them as well.
Absolutely. And all of this was during the COVID pandemic and lockdowns of 2020. How was that? Did you have to go through it all alone?
So my brain surgery was probably the worst one. I literally just had to get dropped off outside the hospital and then go in by myself. I wasn't allowed anyone to come in with me. So it was literally say your goodbyes at the door and then walk in. I didn't know if I was going to see my family again. Then waking up on the other side, obviously relief that I'm, still alive, but then having to recover from that alone, that was pretty dark. I would say there was, some dark moments in that. But that actually gave me kind of the instigation to get out. I wanted to leave. I wanted to get out of the hospital as soon as I could so that I could see my family. I knew that my mum would be pacing up and down and beside herself, which she was. So I knew that I needed to get out to see her and to see the rest of my family. And it did help. I was supposed to be in hospital for about a week, and then I left less than 48 hours after my surgery. Don't recommend that to, I'm not saying that everyone will do that. And obviously I got the clear to go. I didn't self-discharge. But it was just, I wanted to be able to prove to the physio that I could get up and I could stand, and that, he wanted me to walk up and down stairs. So I was like, well, I'll walk up and down the stairs as soon as I can walk up the stairs. And it was because of the fact that I knew that my family was at home and that I wasn't able to see them, that kept me going with that and, you know, proving to them that I could shower myself and do laps around the ward. And then I knew that I had more treatment coming up as well. And in my mindset, I was kind of like, right, get me home, get me rehabbed. I need to rehab because I've got chemo coming up soon. So, but yeah, it was tough. I know that there's lots of people that were going through treatment during COVID as well and experienced all the funds of shielding and not being able to go and get yourself a pint of milk if you want to and those sorts of things and relying on everyone else around you as well. And for me, it was very frustrating. I'm a very independent person. So having to rely on everyone around me was very difficult. I didn't really have a choice. I don't know anything different. You know, I only know being on my own. I only know having chemo by myself. I don't know what it's like to have a chemo friend, in, you know, as they have in the leaflets and things like that. So kind of now I'm very much, now that I can have people come in with me, I find it quite strange. If my mum wants to come into the hospital with me, I'm like, nah, it's fine. Stay at home. I don't mind.
And has there been no ongoing effects after your brain surgery and your brain tumour on your, you know, cognitively?
Cognitively, it's kind of a different, if it's a difficult one, I think. Like, my memory is shocking, but they don't know whether that's because of the radiotherapy that I had or the fact of being in a medically induced menopause. And there's so many different things that it could be that make my memory as horrendous as it is. So I do have to write notes for everything. If someone asks me to do something, I have to write it down. Otherwise, it will literally go out of my mind. Or if I open an email and I don't reply to it, then it's like it's never existed, which is why I know that it was quite hard to get hold of me for this, because I will read an email and then if I don't reply to it, then I will forget that it's even in my inbox. I have had long-standing effects of like nerve damage. So I've got nerve damage on the right side of my face, not visually, thankfully, but by touch. So if I like scratch the temple on the right side of my face, it feels like someone's putting needles in my eye and things like that. So, and it's lessened over time, but it's at the point now that it is how it will always be. At the beginning, it was unbearable to, you know, put moisturizer on my face or to wash my face and things like that. Because as soon as I would touch the right side of my face, then I would then get these really sharp pains in my eye. And I had a lot of numbness around my mouth on the right side, and I wasn't able to eat because I wasn't able to open my mouth because they have to cut through all of the chewing muscles, essentially. So that has recovered, but I still can't, like, I still, you know, if I go to take a large mouthful, I'm like, oh, my jaw. So it's, you know, I still can't fully open my mouth like I used to be able to, or, and yeah, I do have long-standing nerve damage. But in terms of the cognitive, thankfully, actually, my surgeon did an incredible job. And in terms of the radiotherapy, because it was CyberKnife, they managed to miss the optic nerve, which is what they said that if I had the other type, the generalized radiotherapy, I would have gone blind in my right eye because of the location of where the tumor was and where they would have had to cover. But thankfully, due to these new technologies, they're able to pinpoint exactly where it is. And so I've kept my sight in my right eye. So that was a huge win.
Well, yeah.
Obviously. Yeah.
And that's all thanks to research and all the advancements we've had in the last, you know, few years. So, wow, thanks. Yeah. Thanks to that.
Yeah.
And just tell us a little bit about your background before your diagnosis in terms of exercise. You talked about training and racing, but what were you racing? I know you mentioned Ironman.
Yeah. So originally my kind of sporting background, I suppose, started off weightlifting. So when I went to university, I was just studying psychology, nothing sport related at all. And kind of funnily, actually, I hated PE as a child. I was very self-conscious. I was kind of a bit of the dumpy one in school. And even though I was quite good at sport, I hated being in PE. I hated being exposed and being in front of kids in shorts and a t-shirt and made to do sport. So I used to forge notes from my mum. And so they didn't have to take part in PE. And I used to go in with like tape to tape up my fingers and pretend that I'd sprained a finger or these kind of things. So I never had to actually do PE. And then it all kind of then changed when I went to university. Because actually during my first year of university, I became anorexic. So I had an eating disorder. And I had to leave university to then recover from that. And I picked up weightlifting, and that really helped with my recovery because, you know, as kind of cliche as it sounds, I did go from the mindset of wanting to be skinny to then wanting to be strong. And it was a complete game changer for me. So I was kind of, and in those days as well, it was, it's not really that long ago, but you wouldn't see girls in the weightlifting kind of area in the gym. I was still very new at that time. So a lot of my friends used to ask to come along with me and then see what I was doing. And they knew that I was lifting weights and they wanted to kind of get involved, like female friends. And so I then started to train them. And then that's when I then found the love for training other people and seeing them grow and seeing them, you know, flourish in terms of their self-esteem and confidence. And that's how I then got into the fitness industry. Ironically, I then decided to do this challenge for cancer research in memory of my grandparents, where I would do an event every month for a year and then finish with the Ironman.
For anyone who is not aware, an Ironman?
Yeah, so it's a triathlon, essentially, but it's an insane triathlon.
Extreme.
It's an extreme triathlon, yeah. And you've got, so after your swim, which is a 4K swim, I want to say, 3.9, you then do 180 kilometres on the bike and then you finish with a marathon.
Casual.
Yeah, yeah. So that was the aim. And it was going very well, but thank you, COVID. And then obviously all of my diagnosis. I actually haven't finished it. But, you know, never say never. But I was doing all of my challenges. So I then started to race. And then so it just kind of started off with doing some 10Ks and kind of at the beginning, like the first like month. And then I was like, oh, do you know what? I'll push myself a little bit more. So then I did the Richmond Duathlon. And I hadn't ridden a bike since I was about 12 years old in Centre Park. So that was an interesting one, getting like, you know, my first kind of road bike. And then I was like, yeah, I can do a duathlon. That's fine. Take it up Richmond Hill multiple times. Yeah. And then it just kind of grew from there, really. So every month I was doing either a running or a duathlon or a triathlon. And then endurance sport, I suppose, became my thing in that time. Obviously with the end goal of being Ironman. But weightlifting's still always been my passion. And that's what I then got back into now, but with a combination. So now I'm a CrossFitter. So I kind of have combined the endurance and the cardiovascular stuff with the weightlifting and with other crazy things thrown in the mix, as anyone that sees CrossFitters do will understand.
I've got so many questions to ask you relating to that. But first, I just wanted to ask, because I didn't know about your eating disorder.
Oh, yeah.
You had anorexia when you were at university. Mm. Has all of this allowed you to have a sustained recovery from that? Or is it something that it still affects you?
Oh, yeah. So I would say that before I was diagnosed with cancer, things were good. They always say that, you know, having an eating disorder, it will never go away. It'll always live with you. It's whether you can manage it. And my dietitian at the time, she was incredible, and she described it as having like the gremlin on your shoulder, and it's whether you listen to the gremlin. And I learned very well to not listen to the gremlin, kind of in my early 20s and going forward. But I would say that since diagnosis and going through treatment, it becomes very difficult because, you know, when you're pumped with steroids and different medications, you're put on an hormonal medication that then puts you into a medical menopause, and then you will gain some weight from that. And I am 15 kilos heavier than before I started my cancer treatment. Now, admittedly, quite a lot of that is because I also then changed my training. So I went into CrossFit and I have gained a lot more muscle mass. However, my body shape is completely different. My hips are so much bigger than they used to be. I'm like three dress sizes bigger than I used to be. All those things are massive triggers for me. And I had a lot of low moments going through treatment and where I really struggled seeing the weight go on. I got back into the habit of weighing myself, which wasn't helped by the fact that when you obviously go in for treatment, they weigh you at there. So that started to trigger me. I then started to weigh myself at home. So I did do things to help. So I said to my team, if you weigh me, you cannot read out the number. I don't want to see the number on the scale, but also the nurse can't kind of say it while she's writing it down. I don't want to know. I can't know.
Which I imagine is very hard given that you usually get a different member of staff every time you go to the hospital and you get passed between so many different people.
Yeah, so if it was someone new or someone that I hadn't had before, I would then just say, oh, by the way, can you not say the number? I'm not going to look. And they know. They kind of, I think they get it quite a lot. So I never had anyone kind of go, oh, why is that? Or anything. You know, it was, oh, yeah, that's fine. But I also found that my way of, if I lose control in other aspects of my life, and this is very common with people with eating disorders, when you find that you are losing control, the only thing that you feel like you can control is your weight and your diet and your exercise. And so that's where the gremlin, I suppose, as it was a lot harder to not listen to, because I had no control over my cancer or my treatment plan and what it was doing to my body. So in my mind, the only thing that I could control was what's on my plate and what I eat and what I don't eat, essentially, and then trying to control my weight, which I then discovered actually I have zero control over when you're going through treatment as well, because there's so many other factors that come into it. But it was, it was very hard to kind of know in my mind I really need to eat well and eat enough food to keep my body healthy to withstand the treatment that's going on. But then also with having that background, not relapse and not kind of think, oh, well, I'm another kilo heavier, another kilo, or I shouldn't eat that then. Okay, let's slash my calories down. And, you know, I'd be lying if I said it didn't happen. Yes, it did. There were times where I ate significantly less than what I should do, but I got help for it. And I think that's a big thing. Like as soon as I started to see that happen, I reached out. I told my team about it. I told my nurse about it. They know my history. They know, you know, everything to do with my anorexia and the eating disorder that I had. I was very open with them about that from the beginning. So I worked with a dietitian and then kind of gradually got, you know, a little less panicked about the whole weight aspect of it. I still fluctuate now in terms of my mental health with it. I still struggle. You know, I'd be lying if I said that I'm absolutely fine with it. No, I'm not. But there are ways that you can deal with it. And I think particularly now in the sport that I'm in, that really helps, because we eat a lot. And like, I'm in the gym with other girls who are eating a lot. And so I see them eating that and knowing that that's fueling them for what we're about to do when we train. And also it helps me in my job now to educate people that are going through cancer treatment that, you know, you do still need to eat, because I see it. But then, you know, I kind of need to practice what I preach, right? Because I tell my clients, you need to eat to be able to maintain your muscle mass and these kind of things. It sort of helps in some ways, because I then need to be like, oh, actually, well, I'm telling her that, so why am I not doing it myself, you know?
Thank you for being honest about the fact that you still struggle with it, because I'm sure that will resonate with people. And also, I'm really pleased to know that your team have been supportive around that, because, you know, from what I remember from having chemo, my advice from my oncologist was eat as much food as you can, because your body needs it. And I can imagine that if you have an eating disorder, that's really hard to hear and really hard to do.
Yeah, especially when some of the advice is like, eat whatever you want, just, you know, whatever you fancy, eat cake. And you're like, I don't want to eat the cake. Yeah. I got it through when I had the surgery as well, because when your body is recovering from surgery, if you don't eat and you don't, you know, fuel yourself, then actually your recovery is going to be significantly slower than what it would be if you maintain that healthy diet.
Yeah. You know? And also trust that things will change, because I know with me, I put on weight when I had my secondary diagnosis and started a load of drugs that basically did things to my hormones and my, you know, put me into even more of a menopause than I was before. But that regulated over time, and I kept eating, lots and kept eating well. So, but also just talk to your team about these things as well.
100%.
I'm Gareth, the editor of Vita magazine. Vita is Breast Cancer Now's magazine for anyone affected by breast cancer. It's full of inspiring real-life stories, expert tips on coping with the effects of breast cancer, and articles on health and well-being. In our new spring issue, you can read about a mother and daughter who were both diagnosed with breast cancer 12 years apart, find out the latest in breast cancer research, get tips on coping with fatigue, read about the benefits of getting outdoors, and much more. Subscribe to Vita now at breastcancernow.org/Vita.
So, back to exercise. Mm-hmm. You're a personal trainer. You were a personal trainer before yeah. you got your diagnosis, but you incredibly kept on exercising and training throughout your chemo yeah. and your treatment. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of got a bit of a reputation, I think, for being slightly nuts. but actually, all what I did was, it was sensible and it wasn't nuts. I think just to the outside world, it probably looked it. So I've been a coach for a number of years now. God, maybe 8 years. When I started to go through chemo, I knew in myself, just from the kind of the background that I had in terms of my job, that I the importance that it would have for me to be able to keep exercising, one for fatigue, I knew that was a big thing anyway, but then also I knew that one of the side effects from chemo, as I said, was muscle wastage, because for various different reasons, one, the drug itself, but then also two, because you become more sedentary. So the more sedentary we are, the more prone we become to then losing the muscle that we've got, because obviously we're not working them. Those two things pretty much terrified me, I would say. Like, I didn't want to be fatigued. I wanted to still be able to coach my clients as much as I could do. You know, I was self-employed as well. So from a financial perspective, it was tough. And obviously we had COVID anyway, but I still had clients online that I could still try and coach and be there on the other side of the laptop. But then also, before I went into treatment, I was the fittest I'd ever been. You know, I was obviously training for the Ironman and everything, and I loved my body for the first time in a long time, and I loved what it was doing, and I loved the strength that it had and the fitness that it had, and I didn't want to lose all of that, and I knew that I was going to lose that inevitably, some of it, but I wanted to try and keep as much of that as I could. And in my head I was like, well, there must be some sort of correlation between if I try and keep up my strength and my fitness to getting through this treatment and to try and get it through it in a safe but healthy way. As you can probably tell, I am a geek and I do my research, and I knew what these drugs were they were going into me and everything, and I knew what it would do to my body, and I knew the sort of the side effects it can have on your heart and things like that. So it helped me mentally to write myself a bit of a training program and to think, okay, I'm going to try and stick to this and do this a couple times a week out around kind of the 3 to 4 day window when I might feel a little bit rubbish. And I very much learnt quickly and the hard way of how you need to kind of reserve your energy when you're going through chemo. So my first chemo session, I came out thinking that I was superwoman. I think the amount of steroids that I had, I came home and I was like, I actually feel great. Like, this is fine. Don't know what this like chat about EC is. I don't know what they've had and I haven't.
What's EC?
EC, the type of chemo. EC. Yeah, sorry, yeah. And so when I came home from my first one of that, I felt absolutely fine. The following day, my mum came down to visit and we went on a 8K walk, came home. I did a workout. I did one of my sessions. I was, doing some push-ups, a bit on the bike, some lunges, various different things. She thought I'd lost the plot. And then the following day, I went to Sainsbury's and I had to get an Uber home. And that shocked me because I've never had to use public transport to kind of, get home from the shops, right? It's like 15 minutes around the corner from my house. So I very quickly learned that's not what you do. You don't have chemo and then exercise to that level. So then the second time I then had it, felt a little bit worse, as you do with these. Obviously, they're cumulative, that's the one. But I still moved. I would say I would move rather than put myself through that level of intensity that I did before. So I still kept up with kind of walking, but to a lesser of degree. I didn't go for the kind of 8-9K. I use my resistance bands at home to try and still preserve, as I said, muscle and the strength that I had. But it was kind of an experiment for me. I was changing the program as I was going through it, and I was writing different things and trying different ways of still exercising, but always keeping some energy in the tank. And that's what I always say to everyone is you still want to move and you still want to do some activity and exercise, but you always want to do it knowing that you've got energy reserves in the tank. If you don't, then that's what's then going to cause you to then get the Uber home from Sainsbury's the next day. From there, once I'd kind of got through the EC and then I went on to paclitaxel, it became a little bit better in terms of my like my nausea and things like that. And I was recovering a little bit quicker than I was from the EC before. So that's when I then started to do more kind of like intensity stuff that I was used to, still very much to a less degree than what I had done before. But I never fatigued in chemo. That was the number one thing that I never experienced. And so from that, was that there must be some sort of correlation between the fact that I've kept up my exercise and I'm moving a lot. And what they say is actually true. The fact that, you know, they do say if you try and move, then movement helps with fatigue, not just in cancer, but in general, kind of, you know, other health conditions that cause fatigue. Movement can help, whether that be a 10-minute walk, you know, just something to try and kickstart, because you can go on a downward spiral if you feel fatigued. So you sit down, you don't move. So then you feel even more tired. So you sit down, you don't move. And you're kind of always on this downward spiral unless you break it. And when I then went through the 6 months of chemo and I came out the other side, not having experienced fatigue, but knowing that I had kept up with my exercise all the way through, it was like, there must be something to do with that. Also in terms of like my strength, when I'd actually was allowed to go back into the gym and gyms reopened after COVID and I went back into weightlifting, yeah, I was weaker than what I was before, but that was always going to happen. But I could still lift. I knew that I had a long way to go to where I was, you know, before, but I was actually quite surprised and pleasantly surprised at the amount of muscle mass that I'd managed to just maintain. And that was my aim the whole time going through chemo. I knew that I wasn't going to get stronger. And that's what I try and say to, you know, all of my clients as well. Like, you won't get stronger going through chemo. We can never think of it as a linear progression. Your aim now is to maintain and that, or and to not drop off as much as you would do if you weren't to move. I proved to myself that I had done that. So kind of the experiment, I guess, that I put myself through in those 6 months proved to myself that actually exercise works. And then the fact that I had such a fantastic outcome of my treatment as well. And I said to my oncologist when I got my clear results, because he actually had said himself, you know, you've constantly moved, you've always, and he was always very pro that. He never wanted me to stop that. And he said, you know, listen to your body. Mm. And that's what I did the entire time. And then when we got the clear results and I said to him, do you think there is anything involved in this? The fact that I've kept moving and I've responded so well to treatment. And he said, yes. And so from there, that's when I was like, right, that's why I've then gone into the job that I do now. I will never, ever say that exercise is a treatment. It's not a treatment on its own. You should never view exercise as a cure for cancer. That's not what we're saying. But it complements the treatments that you will have in the hospital. And it actually, because of the fact that it helps you to get through it and you can stay strong, you can keep your heart healthy when you're going through chemo. Because of that, it should be seen, and they are starting to actually view it now as a treatment for cancer, but alongside medical treatment, and the two work hand in hand. I was determined to not become what you see on the films and the TV, which is completely not what happens anyway. That, no. You know,
they always get thinner, whereas actually when you're on chemo, yeah, you have steroids, you always get bloated and...
You know. And you don't go grey, you go red instead.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was determined to not go down that route. But then as it then progressed in the 6 months, I then started to see the huge benefits that I was having from it. And then that's what then led me into... qualifying for what I do now and moving forward with that.
It's absolutely incredible. I hadn't realised quite the extent of the amount and the intensity of the exercise you were doing throughout your chemo treatment. And then to have that result afterwards and to still be able to lift, you know, not too different is incredible. So tell us about what you do now with cancer patients.
Yeah, so I think I was sat in the chemo chair at the time and I was like, right, there has got to be some sort of qualification that I can get because more people need to know about the benefits of exercise when you are going through cancer treatment. And I can't just sit here and sort of say like, hello, you know, I'm an advocate for this. I need to have actual grounding for it. And then sure enough, there actually was. So I came across CAN Rehab, which is the qualification that I've got. And it meant that I could then work with cancer patients using exercise. And it's not physio, but it's a exercise specialist. So in the hour sessions that I have with them, we exercise as you would do with a personal trainer. But it's working with someone that is qualified to be able to exercise, knowing what drugs you're on, knowing what surgery you've had. And, you know, if you're going through chemo and you've got a PICC line or a port, it's knowing about what movements you can and can't do with those particular things. When I then started to research into this qualification, I was like, right, that's what I'm going to do. So I started studying just before I finished chemo. So I started, studying while I was going through treatment. Then when I finished treatment, then I then ramped it up, did all of my exams. And then I qualified kind of around the same time that I found out that I had the all clear, actually. And that's what I've done ever since. So since around kind of September 2021, I have been a cancer exercise rehabilitation specialist is actually my formal title. And I love it. The work that I do, it's rewarding, doesn't even do it justice, I think that, you know, but it's it is incredible to see the benefits, not just physical, but mental, that exercise has on people when they're going through treatment. And a lot of actually what I do is prehab stuff as well. It's not just rehabilitation after treatment, but it's actually prehabbing people before they go into treatment or before they go into surgery. So I'll be working with someone that's, for example, going through chemo at the moment. And so our goal at the moment is, as I've said before, is to maintain. So to try and prevent muscle atrophy, try and prevent fatigue. But also from a mental health perspective, it just helps them to feel normal because they're doing something that is outside of the hospital and it's outside of the world of cancer. And it's something that maybe they did before or maybe they didn't do before. They might not have exercised before and this is a new thing to them. They can feel the benefit of it. They can feel the benefit of particularly strength training and using weights because it makes you feel powerful. But they do, you know, so I'll be working with someone through chemo doing that, but then we're knowing that we've got surgery coming up, whatever surgery that might be. So I've got people at the moment that are, I'm leading them into having a hysterectomy and a mastectomy. And there's various different things that we'll be doing. So if it's mastectomy, we're working a lot on upper body strength and mobility because your mobility can suffer once you've gone through mastectomy surgery. And there's a massive correlation at the moment. The NHS are now starting to see it, that the more we prehab patients going into surgery, actually it's more cost effective for them because the recovery times are quicker, which means they don't have to be an inpatient for as long. They don't have to be on medications for as long. So it means that they don't have to get prescriptions for as long. And so I kind of, when I first started my job, it was really hard. It was really hard to get people to listen and to see the importance of exercise and to take it seriously. Whereas now with more research that's coming out, they're seeing that this is legit because it's a win-win. You know, the patient wins, but also the NHS wins because they're not having to spend as much money in terms of their aftercare. But then also, obviously, from the rehab perspective, I get people that have come to me post-treatment, and it might even be like a year post-treatment, but as you know, like, you still have side effects afterwards, and I still get side effects of kind of the chemo side of things, like, even though it was feels like ages ago. And from that kind of element, it's that is where you can then start to rebuild. So I call it the rebuild, because when we're rehabbing, yeah, we can start to build strength again. And then seeing people start to lift heavier, and when they come back to me week on week, and then they start to be able to lift like the heavier dumbbell the next week, or they might be able to do like a couple more reps than they were able to do the week before. And then just seeing the kind of the little like glint in their eye, like you can always see it, and you know that they're starting to believe in themselves again. And I think that's a huge thing as well, is that when we go through these kind of terrible diagnoses, really, you lose your self-belief, because you kind of, whether you consciously or subconsciously think it, you kind of think, why has my body done this to me? And it's very easy to kind of blame your body for it. And it was something that I talked to my therapist a lot about, was the fact that I kind of blame my body for doing this to me. And that was something that I battled with for quite a long time. And my clients are very open with me, which I'm really grateful for. And I try and create like an open space for them to talk about it in the session. And it's a common theme that I get with a lot of people that I see, is that they don't like their bodies anymore because their body did this to them. Whereas when you're then going through the, you know, the kind of the training programs that they go through with me, they can start to accept their body again and like their body again, because their body is actually helping them so much. You know, it wasn't your body that did this to you. Your body is actually trying to help you now. You know, it's, we're putting it through hell essentially in terms of these treatments, but it's still there for you. As you can tell, I love what I do.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that the reward for your mental health as well, for yeah. improving someone else's mental health, is has a knock-on effect to you. So, yeah, what yeah. a great job.
And also, it's kind of, we have chats, you know, like they'll chat to me, they ask me questions. I'm very open with them and honest with them about my treatment and what's going on with me. And I think that's also what they love about it as well, is the fact that I'm not just trying to help them, you know, with their exercise and things like that, but I understand it. Like, yeah. I've been through it myself. So it's kind of, I would say, like 75% exercise, 25% therapy sometimes. Or sometimes it might be like half and half. They've got that safe hour where they can talk to me about anything. And if they've got worries, or, you know, their bloods might not have been so good, or maybe they've got like scan results coming up, like, I get that. I understand the scanxiety, as we call it. It's not just the physical side of things, but it's the mental health side of things that I think is so important. And that's quite a large bit that's missed, I think, in terms of when you're going through treatment, like not having that exercise specialist to go through that with you. But ever since I qualified, it was always my goal that when you're sat in that room and you get that diagnosis, that you will have an exercise specialist that will go through this with you. So I'm just hoping that, you know, I can build up an army.
Got it. Well, you're tempting me, but I think I've got too many jobs at the moment. Yeah. But I would definitely train with you. So how does someone sign up to be your client?
Yeah, so I've got a website. It's called One Step Training. The reason behind the name is because when I was going through treatment, and people said, and even now people say to me, how did you get through it? How do you get through all of this? You know, you've from the brain surgery and then the chemo and like stage 4 and you're young and da da da. Like, how are you dealing with all of this mentally? And I was like, to be honest, I've always had the same motto going through treatment, and that's literally taking one step at a time. And I never thought about the bigger picture or coming out of it, or, you know, what's going to happen in a year's time, or even what's going to happen in a week's time. I would literally just think, well, what's the next step that I have to do? And whether that was just go and have a scan, not think about the result, but have the scan. So at the beginning, I was like, okay, right, so I've got to go and have an MRI. I'm not going to think about the result of the MRI. I just know that I've got to go and have an MRI. You have the MRI. What's the next step? Go and see the oncologist. Obviously, yes, for the results, but I wouldn't think about that. I would just think, what's the next step? Hospital. That's it. That's all I need to think about. I know that on Monday morning, I've got to go to the hospital. And breaking it down into really small steps like that really helped me. And when I started to kind of tell other people about that, then it started to help them. And I saw that actually as simple as it sounds, just one step at a time, if you actually properly break it down, it does significantly help. And that's kind of, I suppose, what inspired the name for this now, is because I try and get my clients to see that as well, and patients to see that, that, you know, don't look at the bigger picture in the sense of, okay, you can't do one push-up now, so how are you going to do 10? Don't think about it like that. Just think the aim is one, right? The one step that we're going to get to is actually doing an incline push-up on a wall, right? That's your step one. That's all I want you to do. And they can do that. So it's like, okay, you can do that, right? So then we then build it into stages, right? So everything always has a one step in front, and you never have to think about 2, 3, 4, because that's way too overwhelming for anyone to cope with. And so that's what inspired the name for this. So I do one-to-ones in London, house visits, and I've got a space in Vauxhall, gym space there that I use. But I also see clients all over the world, which is really pretty cool. Whether you've got bits of kit at home or not, doesn't matter. I kind of always start off my online clients with one piece of kit, and that's just a resistance band, and that's all they need. So it means that I can access everyone from anywhere. Yeah, so you can find me on onesteptraining.com.
Perfect, and we'll put those links in the show notes as well. We know there are benefits to exercise, not just in terms of building strength after or during cancer, but also in terms of helping keep cancer away.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so see, there has been long-standing research anyway into the kind of the preventions of cancer, right? So there's lots of different things that people say that you can do to prevent your chance of getting cancer, and that's a combination of, you know, not smoking, drinking, diet, and exercise has always been a big one. Kind of reasons for that, weight. So there is a correlation between obesity and cancer. So obviously exercising helps with keeping weight down and the prevention of obesity, which can then help with the prevention of cancer. Hormonal profiling as well. So actually for females that have a higher body fat percentage, that can then increase the kind of the estrogen levels, which can then cause cancers. Again, breast cancer is a big one for that. So when you're then talking about people that have already been diagnosed with cancer, but then have come out the other side of it, and we're talking about the reoccurrence rates, kind of have to view it in the same way, that, you know, if you do exercise and you can keep your body, like the hormonal profiling regular, and you can keep your weight down as much as possible after treatment as well, then that all contributes to reoccurrence rates and mortality rates too as a result of that. So... yeah, even when you have had cancer and you come out the other side of it, still view the knowledge and the research that we have that exercise prevents cancer, even if you already have it, you know. Because, like, for me, I exercised as a vegetarian, no family history, and didn't drink, smoke, whatever. I still got cancer. So if I was to then view that and then go, well, I did all of these things and I still got cancer, so screw it, I'm just going to do all of those things, I would just be shooting myself in the foot. Whether that's because of the fact that I've already had it and it's a reoccurrence that would have happened, or I've accelerated the chance of it happening again because of the fact that I then did all of these things that then increased the carcinogens, and, you know. So for that reason, I would always say to people, don't view it as a kind of give up case of, oh, well, it's happened now, so, you know, I'm just not even going to bother. Actually, no, still see it as a way to try and prevent reoccurrence from happening by doing exercise. Then you're helping with that, as well as trying to keep your weight down, which obviously, you know, we discussed at the beginning, like, it can happen and it happens to all of us with these treatments. So if we can try and keep it down as much as possible, then it then all then contributes to helping prevent the cancers from coming back.
Yeah. Where if someone is going through cancer treatment or has just had a surgery and has never lifted weights before and they have no idea where to start, what would you recommend they do to get started?
First of all, always seek a professional. If you haven't done anything before, don't start trying to do like YouTube videos and, you know, things kind of, and HIIT training and things like that, because it's too intense. And HIIT training and stuff, especially like on YouTube videos, they include a lot of plyometric stuff, which is not what you want to be doing right at the beginning.
What's plyometric?
Plyometric, so jumping.
Oh, right.
So things like squat jumps, star jumps, tuck jumps, those kind of things. You know, a lot of HIIT training videos on YouTube include that, and I'm not naming names of people, but there are particular people out there that have YouTube videos that use a lot of jumping in as part of their workout videos, and it's very easy to jump on those and to follow those, because you probably think like, oh, I'm a beginner, so I'm gonna, you know, follow along with these videos, but actually they're not designed for people that have, you know, A, gone through these various different treatments or have had these surgeries, but also if you've never done anything near that, you'll find that you'll be incredibly sore and it'll probably put you off and you'll never want to do it again. So the first and foremost, it would be to seek someone that is a professional to help guide you through that. But then also just starting off with body weight. Like, if you think what you weigh is what you're then going to be working with when you do certain body weighted movements, right? So a body weighted squat, you're working with your body weight. Body weighted lunges, you're working with your body weight. Push-ups, planks, you know, all these different things. There's so much that you can do with your body that you are using the load of yourself without having to even lift anything up additionally. So you don't even have to lift a weight at the beginning. You don't have to fear lifting weight to get resistance training. And I think that's a big thing. When you talk about resistance training, people automatically think lifting heavy weight and that's scary and I can't do that. But that's not what we mean when we talk about resistance training. It's about moving your body with additional load, but using your body and doing lunges and squats, that's still resistance training because you're still working your muscle. You know, you're not going for a run. You're not doing cardiovascular stuff. You're not doing star jumps, right? But you're actually doing controlled movement. It's all about training your body to move in a safe and effective way, building strength back up in whatever way that might be, whether that's using your body at the start or starting to introduce some resistance weights in. People get scared at the beginning, and that's completely normal. It's completely normal to feel scared and intimidated by exercise. But it's about viewing exercises different to what you probably think it is right now. And it's not the kind of hard, sweaty, grunting type of training that you probably see and think that that's what exercise is. It's not. It should be fun, but you should come out of it feeling better than when you walked in.
Yeah. And I think one of the fantastic points you've made is the one about prehabbing before treatment and before surgery, because I think a lot of people will think about getting better after cancer treatment, after surgery, but actually you can do it before, during and after. And that's really...
And actually the sooner you start, the better.
Yeah.
I think that's a huge thing. A lot of people... I have had people come to me and say, oh, I've got, you know, chemo... start, like I'm in the middle of chemo, I finish in 3 months time, can I contact you in 3 months and start then? And I say, well, you can, but actually it's better if you start now. And sometimes that can be because people are feeling so fatigued and pretty rubbish and their self-confidence has taken a massive dip, so they mentally they think, oh, in 3 months' time, I'll be out of this phase of my treatment. So I won't be fatigued and I'll feel a bit stronger and I'll just feel more myself. But actually, it's the opposite. But you might as well try now before you actually get to that point. So then you can kind of nip it in the bud, as they say.
Just to go back to the cancer diagnosis. So you were obviously given this incredibly bleak diagnosis a few years ago. If someone is listening to this podcast and has just had a similarly awful diagnosis or prognosis, what would you say to them?
I would say at the moment it feels terrifying and the unknown is the worst. If you don't know what your treatment is that's coming up and what that's going to look like, that's often the worst part of it. Once you get your treatment plan and you know the direction that you're heading in, it'll feel a lot clearer and it'll feel better. But I would then say that all through it all, just don't give up hope. That's the number one thing that I kept throughout the entire time. I didn't know if I was going to come out the other side. I knew that I was going to go through all of these treatments, but I didn't know if it was going to be a wasted effort. But I just never saw it as a wasted effort. I always tried to keep holding on to the hope that I had that, you know, if we're going to try everything and the greatest outcome that we can have is that I'll still be here on the other side of it. That's, you know, that's the best result that we can have. Times can feel bleak and there can be times where you do want to give up on hope. But if you hold on to that and then you keep believing in yourself and believing in the work that is going into these treatments and the research that's going into it and more things are coming out, and just hold on to that, you'll get through it.
Yeah. On that note, we ask everyone the same question at the end of this podcast, which is, if one thing could change in terms of breast cancer diagnosis, treatment and beyond in the next few years, what would you like to happen?
When you have that diagnosis and you receive that as part of your information that you get, whether that be from the team or the leaflets that you get and things like that, you have access to an exercise specialist. You know, you have access to your nursing team, your oncologist, you have access to the dietitians in the hospital, physiotherapists, but we don't have enough access to a cancer exercise and rehabilitation specialist. And that's the number one thing that I really want everyone to be able to have access to, or pointed in the right direction, because people don't know that we exist and people don't know that actually exercise is so important for your treatment and you can still trust your body when you're going through treatment to be able to do these things and not feel weak and not feel scared to move in certain ways.
And in the meantime, until we have that access for everyone, how can people find you online, on social media?
So on my Instagram is at Fran Whitfield. And then in my bio there is the link to my website as well. And happy to receive DMs or there's a form submission on my website that you can write a form out and then it goes straight to my email. And then I then contact people from there to then get them started.
And we'll obviously put all those links in the show notes as well. Final question. How are you going to celebrate your 30th birthday this year?
Oh, that's a big question. Party, obviously. And then I really want to do kind of my dream trip to go to Africa. I've wanted to do it ever since I was a little kid. And it was kind of one of the things that I was so fearful of. I'm never going to see an elephant. And so I really want this year to be the year that I see an elephant. And not in a zoo.
Elephant.
An actual elephant in the wild. That's how I want to celebrate.
That sounds like a great plan. Well, I wish you all the best in your year of work and exercise and travels and elephant spotting and congratulations. And Fran, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
No, thank you for having me. It's been great.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Breast Cancer Now podcast, make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please also leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts and perhaps recommend it to someone you think would find it helpful. The more people we can reach, the more we can get Breast Cancer Now's vital resources to those who need them. You can find support and information on our website, breastcancernow.org, and you can follow Breast Cancer Now on social media at Breast Cancer Now. All the links mentioned in this episode are listed in the show notes in your podcast app. Thank you for listening to the Breast Cancer Now podcast.